Let's start with the lab quiz first. And let's start with kinetics versus thermodynamics. Let me put up the appropriate reaction coordinate diagram. So remember that the reaction that we discussed was the reaction of 1,3-butadiene. And first part of the discussion we had, even before talking about this reaction coordinate diagram, was about conjugation. That was really the entry into this topic. That there's this carbocation that, although I don't normally represent it this way, just for brevity's sake I'll do so, there's one carbocation that's delocalized that we can write with two different resonance structures. But those two different resonance structures, neither one of them truly exists. The carbocation is really a combination of those two structures. So the whole point of that is to stress that there's only one energy level involved, but there are two different products that form. When the next bond starts to form, because this is a reaction of that butadiene with HBr, once bromine does come in to form a bond, that forces the carbocation to become localized in one position or another. And we end up with the possibility of localizing it at a primary position or a secondary position. Well, the secondary position is more favorable due to hyperconjugation. But that ends up producing a product that thermodynamically is not as favorable. So we end up with a low activation barrier. A low activation barrier, but the less favorable product. The other possibility is to localize at the primary position, which is not as favorable. But if it did so, it would make a product that is thermodynamically more favorable. So it has a higher activation barrier, ends up forming the more stable product. Now, not all reactions, not all competition reactions, have this behavior. There's some that the more stable product is also the lower energy transition state. But when we have this situation where the grabs end up being crossed, then there's a temperature dependency on what products are forming. So at low temperature, especially really low temperature, for an exothermic reaction like this, the reaction is essentially going to be irreversible, that it will move only forward. And that's because if you have an exothermic reaction, automatically the activation barriers in the reverse direction are larger than the forward direction. So because of that, when the reaction is going forward, it sees the two different activation energies. The lower one's easier to overcome, and so that's the faster reaction. And as one of the graphs on my shirt shows us, the at low temperature, what you could say is there are few molecules that have enough energy to reach over an activation barrier. And if you have two different activation barriers you're comparing, the one that's higher energy allows even fewer molecules, or has even fewer molecules that have that energy content. So at low temperature, the low barrier is preferred. The low barrier makes the less favorable product, and that's why that particular product forms, and that's why we refer to that as the kinetic product. The less favorable thermodynamically. Right, it's higher energy thermodynamically, but it was easier to make, and so that's why it's called the kinetic product. Then, as you raise temperature, all reaction rates increase, both forward and reverse. And so as you increase temperature enough, the reverse reaction becomes more and more possible. And then each time the reaction goes forward, because now if it's being reversible, there's multiple chances for it to try to get over that higher activation barrier. Which, again, it's not favorable to do so, but if it makes it over that higher barrier, you drop the most energy of all compared between the activation barrier and the product.
So once you form that most favorable product, it doesn't really want to reverse. It is the slowest reaction of the four forward and reverse reactions, if we ignore steric factors and if we make some assumptions about rate loss. So you make that product, and it accumulates.
And so therefore, it's called the thermodynamic product.
And that's a reasonably short telling of the story. Now, we did have some discussion about Arrhenius' expression and there were those graphs that I put up,
and I'll quickly put those up again. This is the one I was talking about a moment ago, where if you have two different activation barriers, then you can show that the higher activation barrier, again, corresponds to the fewer number of molecules that have the energy to react. There's also the other graph we did where it was one activation barrier, but then we looked at what would happen if we had a system at two different temperatures. Now remember that as you go higher in temperature, the curve broadens, but of course you then also have more molecules at a higher energy per molecule. And so in this case, we can see at cold temperature, fewer molecules over the barrier. High temperature, more molecules over the barrier.
We also had some discussion of trying to justify why, even though equilibrium is a situation where you had equal rates, it doesn't mean that we have equal rate constants. I'm unlikely to ask a question that detailed because I'm more worried about the central concept here, about why is it that changing temperature changes product distribution. So that's the theoretical aspect of it. Does anyone have any question about any of these three graphs that I put up? Then there's the interpretation part of it. There's the lab portion of it, which we've covered already, but I'll run through it again. We had four portions of the experiment, A, B, C, and E. A and B were to make the pure products that you can characterize by melting point, because what was going on in the lab you determined by melting point. Part C is where you did the multiple temperature tests. So you did below room temperature, above room temperature. That was in order to determine which of the products was the kinetic versus the thermodynamic product. As a reminder, we had two starting materials. We had the cyclohexanone and the furaldehyde. And they made derivatives, recall. Rewriting the full structure again, these are semicarbazones, which are similar to hydrazones. If you notice that the molecule, the semicarbazone, is like a derivatized hydrazine. Both of those functional groups, the semicarbazones and the hydrazones, those are very similar to imines. So in fact, the mechanism for forming one of these is the same as the mechanism for forming an imine. It's just, besides the nitrogen that attacks, there's some extra stuff that goes along for the ride. So one of the derivatives was the kinetic product. One of the derivatives is the thermodynamic product. The way we determined that was by melting point.
So recall that the derivative of A had a melting point of about 160, roughly, and B, roughly 200.
And it didn't matter what the melting points were. Just because one had a lower melting point than the other didn't mean anything about thermodynamic stability. It's just a coincidence. It's coincidence because it does turn out that A, the derivative, is the kinetic product,
and B, its derivative, is the thermodynamic. You should know the mechanism. Like I said, it's identical to making an imine. So it's
a modified protonate open attack deprotonate, and then protonate open attack deprotonate. Modified in the sense that you're allowed to have the nitrogen attack the carbonyl before the carbonyl gets protonated. Once that attack occurs, though, then it turns into a cationic mechanism, that before anything else happens, you put a proton on to make the molecule neutral, or at least get rid of the negative charge, and then whatever subsequent steps happen, they occur because of protonation. But that's identical to how we made an imine in class. Now, the two derivatives, we figured out which one was which because at low temperature we ended up with a product mixture that had a melting point closer to 160, which was A's derivative, and at high temperature we ended up with a product mixture that had a melting point that was closer to B's derivative's melting temperature. Then we did part E, which is where we took one derivative and reacted with the contrasting original molecule. And what we were looking for is to see if the semicarbazide switched between molecules. This would only occur if A prime was the kinetic product, which it is. Which means you're going to end up with B prime, which means the melting point should have been in around the 200s. We did the opposite as well. We took B prime and tried to react it with A, but we found out no reaction. And that's because B prime is the thermal product. So in the first time, we made B prime, which means it should have a melting point around 200. The second time, nothing happened. So it should have a melting point about 200. You get the same melting point because in either case, you end up with the thermodynamic product. And since that's B prime, because that's the one that matched closer to melting point, we've confirmed which one is the kinetic and which one is the thermodynamic product. So are there any questions about the lab interpretation part of that? Should we move on to the NMR problems? Oh, yeah, sorry. Yes, that question came up earlier, and again, this is just imine formation. So I hadn't written it out, but it is identical to imine. Other questions? Then let's do the NMR problems. Let me write out the spectral information for the first problem again. It was C6H12, and there were six absorbances. 5.45, which is a doublet of triplets that integrates to one and has a coupling constant, which for this quarter, that's a big fat hint that it's an alkene, because there hasn't been any other functional group that I've shown you a coupling constant for. And I'm not in the mood to play trick questions, so I'm not going to throw a coupling constant in so that, I could then say it's not an alkene. Because, of course, anytime that you have splitting, you have coupling constants. We just don't normally quote them, but for alkenes, we need them because it tells us what kind of alkene we have. Do we have an alkene that has two hydrogens in a cis configuration? Or do we have them in a trans? Or do we have them in geminal? Or do we only have one alkene hydrogen? So, the other absorbances, 5.42 for a doublet of quartets that integrates to one gesundheit with a coupling constant. 1.95, that's a doublet of triplets for 2H. 1.643, that is a doublet for three hydrogens. 1.360, that is a triplet of quartets for two hydrogens. And then finally, 0.885, that's a triplet that integrates to three. Now, how does anybody think that they solve the problem? You think, okay, can you name the compound? I'm not going to make you come up, but I mean, I'm going to ask if you could try to walk us through what your logic was. Hex 2-ene, but what configuration then?
Trans. So Sana thinks that the molecule is that. You're correct.
Did anybody else get the answer? A couple other people? So, can you explain where you started? Okay, wait. It had to be an alkene. Why? Okay, but can you give us some other justification? Okay, besides that, what other information can we use? Let's say that I didn't give you a coupling constant, because what if there was only one hydrogen on the alkene? And what else could we use? Because this is only carbon and hydrogen. There's no oxygen, chlorine, anything that's electronegative. So how did I get a chemical shift that large? That's the answer right there. Alkenes have large chemical shifts. So, degree of unsaturation is 1 in this case,
which means it's a ring or it's an alkene. The chemical shift is greater than 3, therefore, we have an alkene.
We could then wonder which kind of alkene this is. Now, the ranges were, I keep forgetting them. Was it 6 through 14 and 12 through 18? Okay. So, I, in the future, need to give you a better coupling constant. Because I did write down trans as the molecule I was looking at, but one could argue that this is at the very limit of the cis range as well. So next time I'll do something like 15, so you know it's for sure that it's a trans. But remember, we did have those 3 different ranges. We had 0 through 3 for geminal splitting, we had 6 through 14 for the cis splitting, and then 12 through 18 for the trans. Do we see any cis splitting here? If I declare that 14 is actually supposed to be 15 so that you know it's trans, is there any cis relationship here? No. Is there any geminal relationship? That means it can't be a terminal double bond.
Because the only way you could get a geminal relationship is to have a terminal double bond.
So again, up to this point, we know there's a degree of unsaturation. We could guess that maybe it's a ring, but with the chemical shift, we're pretty confident it is an alkene. At the very least, we know that it's not a terminal alkene, because we don't have the appropriate splitting constants. Another way we could guess that, potentially, is the fact that we only have 2 hydrogens that are at that high chemical shift range. If we only had a monosubstant alkene that was terminal, we should have 3 different hydrogens, each with an integration of 1. But we don't have that. Now, how, once you got to this point, did you put the pieces together? What did you look at next? Okay, you looked at the splitting, and where did you start with the splitting? That's fine, because even though these example problems I'd shown you, I maybe gave the impression that I did each one in one method, that you in real life you use all the tools you can. Which is also what I would recommend that you do, is start with things that integrate to three. Because since you've got six different signals, and if we're guessing it's a transalkene, indirectly we know there's six different carbons. Well, we know that because of C6. But in other words, we have six different positions. That means something has to be at the end, and we're not going to have a way of having an integration of three due to symmetry in a molecule this small. So again, integration of three means the end of a molecule, and that's a good place to start. So why don't we take the bottom one, that is the 0.8, that integrates the three. So chemical shift less than one likely means that at the very least it's not at a position allyl to the alkene. Because if you're close to the alkene, that alkene's going to have this D-shielding effect. Without trying to confuse us all, it's sort of similar to what happens in benzene. There's a small loop current that gets generated within the alkene itself. Since we have an integration of three, that's our methyl group. And what does the triplet tell us? That has two neighbors next to it. Where can we go next with that? Where did you go next with that? Okay. So, let me try to help you out with the explanation part. You had two different positions that had integration of two. We know there better be something that integrates to two because this first position here had a triplet, which means there was not a third hydrogen next door. Which, since there's no oxygen in this compound, also means that you know that there's a carbon extending from there. So just from that one peak, we get three carbons partially worth of information. We look back at the two hydrogens. One is a doublet of triplets. One is a triplet of quartets. Which one must these two hydrogens that we just wrote up must be? Which of those two peaks, the doublet of triplets or the triplet quartets, which one is this? It has to be the triplet quartets. Why? Because we got three neighbors over here. This is actually exactly the same logic as one of the problems I worked in class already. I started with a methyl group. From the methyl groups splitting, I knew what was next door. Looking at what was next door, I look back and say, there's the methyl group I just came from. So these two hydrogens I'm moving to, I know have to have a quartet because of the methyl group that's next to them. Once I know that it's the triplet of quartets, I will focus in on the triplet part of it, and I know that yet again, there must be two hydrogens next door. There is only one other peak that integrates to two, so it must correspond to the two hydrogens I just wrote. So the blue hydrogens we just came from, that's what would cause the triplet. And now we have a doublet. What does the doublet mean? That there's only one neighbor. Since we have the degree of unsaturation, the only thing that makes sense, especially since we're already three carbons into the compound, the only thing that would make sense is if we have the alkene. Because that's how we would get our one hydrogen. The other way we know that is because we do have the two peaks, the only two peaks that integrate to one. Those peaks have a chemical shift greater than 5, which means it is an alkene peak. Then we don't really need to look at the rest of the splitting because we've used up 5 carbons. There's only one left, so the only possible answer is to have a methyl group. But let's confirm that. Let's finish the assignments then. And we can figure out which one of these alkene peaks corresponds to this, because if we did reason enough that we knew that this was an alkene peak, you can't have an alkene that's one carbon long, so you know its neighbor also has to be an alkene. If its neighbor is an alkene, there's no way physically it could have 3 hydrogens. If we look again at the signals, the alkene could either be a doublet of triplets, or it could be a doublet of quartets. And actually, we can stop right there, because the hydrogen we just drew must be a triplet, because
it has two hydrogens as neighbors. So we know that it is the peak that's the doublet of triplets. The ones in green cause the triplet, and then there is a doublet, which means only one hydrogen as a neighbor. By process of elimination, there's only one other peak with the right chemical shift, so more correspond to that. And it matches up because the first alkene peak is what would cause the doublet, and then we have the methyl group at the end, that would cause that triplet.
So it's fairly logical as long as you found some place to start. Now, some of you might have tried starting with the alkene,
which, if you had that approach, you could again look at one carbon, the alkene, to realize there had to be a methyl group next door.
So aside from looking for things that integrate to three, you might also look for things that have quartet splitting, because that also will tell you next door is something that has to integrate to three. And for all these small molecule problems, if you see an integration of three, it's safe to assume a methyl group. So questions? Now let's do the next problem, which I'll admit right off the bat is a tough one. And that's why I've started doing that one in class instead of, like a few years ago, on a lab exam. The only reason they had it on the lab exam is because they had a lot more NMR practice than you did. They started in 12A that year doing NMR. Doing NMR problems, not just the theory aspect.
Not that you all couldn't handle it next quarter. It's just you aren't at the same place instruction-wise they were. So let me write down the spectral information for this one. C5H8O with a peak at 6.342. That is a doublet that integrates to one with a coupling constant of 6.2 hertz. Again, a good indicator, both from the chemical shift and the splitting, that it might be an alkene. We have a doublet of triplets that integrates to one. The fact that it integrates to one, again, is indicative of an alkene. So the only other way to have that is a tertiary carbon or an alcohol or something like that. We do have an oxygen, so we'll have to see if we might have an alcohol. Peak at 3.957, that is a triplet that integrates to 2. A peak at 1.984, that is a doublet of triplets that integrates to 2. And 1.846, that is a triplet of triplets that integrates to 2.
Does anybody believe they might have the answer? Yes.
I don't know what is the name there. Is it a beta cyclic compound in the ether or the double?
You know the name of that compound. Where did you use that compound in synthesis?
But instead of writing the answer down, let's see if we can build our way to it so it's even more satisfying once we get there.
So what's the degree of unsaturation?
2. What are our possibilities? A carbon-carbon triple bond, a carbon-carbon double bond with a ring, carbon-oxygen double bond with a ring, or a carbon-carbon and a carbon-oxygen, or 2 rings.
Are there any of these possibilities that we think must be true or can't be true? And let me ask you this. Do you think we have an alcohol? What must we have if we have an alcohol?
An integration of one.
We have to have an integration of one. Based on chemical shift, is it possible that either of those... this is going to be a tricky one. Based on chemical shift, is it possible for either of those top 2 peaks to be an alcohol? Based on chemical shift, yes, the 4.6 falls potentially within the alcohol range. But you can, again, use the fact that I'm not going to pull any trick questions and see that we do have coupling constants there to say, well, no, it's not going to be an alcohol because it's an alkene. If we don't have an alcohol, that means we have an ether, correct? If we have an ether, or we could have a carbonyl, couldn't we? That's the other thing we have to worry about. But if we're believing the chemical shift corresponds to an alkene, that means it has to be one of these 2 possibilities. And actually, based on the coupling constant, what kind of alkene do we likely have? A cis alkene.
So why don't we start there?
One of those hydrogens corresponds to one of the alkene peaks. One of the other hydrogens corresponds to one of the other alkene peaks. Which one would you like to start with? The top one? Okay. Hearing the unanimous applause for the top one, we'll start with the top one. So, that top one has an integration of 1. It's got a really high chemical shift. What might that be indicative of? What in general does a high chemical shift mean? He has some kind of electron withdrawing group, either an electronegative atom or something like a carbonyl. What does the fact that it's only split into a doublet mean? It only has one neighbor, and it only has one of that one neighbor, the other alkene peak.
So I just chose to start with this peak. So there's nothing magic about me making this correspondence. I just start with somewhere. But since it's only a doublet, there's only one neighbor. one side. That means whatever is next door right here has to be a carbonyl or an oxygen. How did I leap to that conclusion? You have to block splitting. So although in the past I've said look for singlets, because that really tells you about blocked splitting, but we can also right here look at the fact that we only had a doublet, not doublet of triplets or whatever. So there's only neighbors on one side. If there was a hydrogen at that position, I'd have a third alkene peak I'd be looking at. But I don't have that. So there's got to be something to block splitting. It could be a quaternary carbon, but I don't have enough carbons to do that. It could be an ether, maybe, with an oxygen further down below. But we'll see in a minute why it's going to be either this carbonyl or this oxygen. So let's leave that alone just for a moment, and let's see if we can figure out any further information from the other alkene peak. So the other alkene peak, it's a doublet of triplets. Well, we know the doublet is due to the first alkene hydrogen, but what does the triplet tell us? That it's only got two neighbors. Alright, let's see if we can figure out which peak corresponds to that, because it has to be something that integrates to two. And we got three choices: a triplet, a doublet of triplets, or a triplet of triplets. Which is it? Because it can only be one of them. It has to be the doublet of triplets. Why? Because it has one neighbor, and only one neighbor, on one of the sides. Now, what happens on the other side, that's what we're going to use this to tell us. But we know that there must be the doublet because there is the one neighbor. So, we know it's the doublet of triplets, the doublet again due to the alkene hydrogen, and then the triplet, well that means again we have two neighbors. Now this is where the trickiness comes in a little bit. Because there are two more peaks that this orange proton could be. And in theory, it could be either the triplet of triplets or the triplet. But what would it mean if it were just the triplet? What would be the only way that the orange peak could correspond to something that was a triplet? If there are no hydrogens on the neighbor next door. Since it's got these green protons, it's got to be a triplet. If it had any hydrogen neighbors, it would be triplets of something. There's some other realization to make, that there is a peak there that integrates to two that is just a triplet. That means that is two hydrogens up against something that won't allow splitting. But I only used up 1, 2, 3, 4 of the carbons. So the only way this would work is to have an oxygen or carbonyl here, but there would still be one more carbon on the other side there.
One, two, three, four, five. You can't have six carbons. So we could put the oxygen there, and there would be one more carbon there, but then how would we block splitting on this side? So the only
solution that makes much sense
is DHP.
This is the spectrum of DHP. And it works because now we can see those orange protons must correspond to the triplet of triplets. Part of the way we could tell that is notice that the orange protons are the furthest from both functional groups. And although I've not exploited chemical shift a lot in my problems, I have in the past tried to stress that you should use chemical shift as part of your information. So the orange, as far as you can get in this compound from both the oxygen and the alkene. And then, with that last peak, it must be just the triplet. It makes sense it has high chemical shift because it's right next to an ether. But because that does take a little bit of a leap of logic right there, that one spot where I kind of jumped to the answer, it's an educated guess I made, which I was then able to justify after the fact looking at the splitting patterns. But that's why I classify this as a more difficult problem. The first problem, with just logic alone, you would get the answer without having to take any huge leaps. Now, questions about this problem? How many of you have done any other NMR practice problems? Okay. So there's not much I could do about that. At the very least, if any of you had asked, you know, could you tell us a specific problem to work on, I would have. Maybe that's my job as a teacher to tell you, but yet you are students, and so it is your job also to ask, and not a single person asked out of any of the three sections to review an NMR problem. So I'm a little stuck what to do other than more review, because your lab quiz is Thursday, and it doesn't look like you all are ready. So how, between now and Thursday, are you all going to be ready to do NMR problems? Because magic doesn't work. Would you like me to try to dig up another problem that we do in class right now, then? Because I will tell you one thing to compensate for all this, which is there are going to be no more lab reports for the quarter. Because there's no way I'm going to look at them at this point. I know this is on recording for someone to listen to later, but anybody that might be listening knows what's been going on this quarter and knows why I don't care if they hear or not. Because I've had a miserable, miserable quarter. And it's been a disservice to you all, actually, that you haven't got as much out of me as you should have been able to. Since you are stuck in this pickle, though, which is partly because of my own causing, I'm not going to throw more work on you right at the end of the quarter that all of a sudden we got these lab reports that you're worried about. So if you don't have that to worry about, now you've got NMR to worry about. So, since you're not worried about lab reports, what does that mean about finishing up lab? You still should do it for your own benefit. Go through with the experiment. Some of you, someone I could tell, I won't name names, wants to finish just to have the personal satisfaction of say, yes, I got the product. You should do that. But it's 8:39 right now. We could have some time to do one more problem if you wanted to. And then there'd be about an hour left so that those of you who did want to finish could. Should we do that? Let's go ahead and go over the answer for this. I know that some of you might be getting close now. But still, we can leave some time for IR and such.
So, if we look at this, we have C5H8O, which means we again have 2 degrees of unsaturation.
Which means we have the same possibilities. It could be a triple bond, it could be 2 double bonds, which could be 2 carbon-carbon double bonds, or a carbon-oxygen double bond, or there's a bunch of possibilities. But if we look at the fact that we've got the geminal splitting, that's one of the biggest clues in this whole problem. Because if we assign either of those with the splitting of 3.3 hertz to be either one of those hydrogens, notice the splitting that we have on those two hydrogens. It's a doublet of doublets. Now, it will be split once into a doublet because of the geminal splitting. But the only way it can again be split into a doublet is if it's got one more neighbor next to it, which means it's a terminal alkene. Let me put colors to some of this so we could rationalize this out. So I'll take the top one of these doublet of doublets and just arbitrarily assign it to this one. And then I'll assign the other one to the other one. Now, coupling constant of 17.5, what does that mean? Trans, doesn't it? And then the 8.7 means cis. So that means there is a third hydrogen on that alkene that is cis to one, trans to the other. And as far as what splits what, the bottom hydrogen is split by the top one and by the one that is trans to it. And then the top one is split by the bottom one and the one that is cis to it. Now, there is not a fourth hydrogen here, because otherwise it would just be the molecule ethene. So there's something connected at this position. Something that has no hydrogen neighbors. Because the green proton, I didn't write that one out yet. I won't write the splitting constants in, because it's up above. The point is, it gets split only by the ones that are cis and trans to it. It doesn't have any other hydrogen neighbors, so that means whatever goes in the circle there has to block splitting. Which means it's likely either an oxygen or a carbonyl. Could potentially be an oxygen, but there's a way we can rationalize this, whether there's an oxygen at that position or not. Because jump down to the last two peeps and look what we got. We have a quartet and a triplet. Either those, both of those are only split once. Look at the integrations. We have 3 and 2.
Also look at the chemical shift, 2.6. That's really close to that...
It's a little higher then. So ignore chemical shift for a moment, but look at the triplet and the quartet. Because if we have a quartet... from two hydrogens, that means, again, that next door, there's no splitting on one side, and we have a methyl group next door. And that would correspond to that last peak. Which, since it's a methyl group, of course it's at the end, so it's only got one kind of neighbor. But look what we got.
We have two carbons that are blocked on one end by splitting, and two other carbons that are blocked on the other end by splitting. Do we have any other carbon-based protons? Do we have any other protons at all? So if there was one more carbon, which there must be because the formula is C5, there's one more carbon, how could we squeeze this in here if it's a carbonyl?
Since four carbons are used up so far, and since there must be one more carbon, without hydrogens on it, that last carbon must be a carbonyl, which means the answer is pent-1-ene-3-ome. Now, how many of you got pieces of this or got close? Okay, so it's starting to make sense a little bit. I would recommend taking all the NMR problems we've done so far, even if it's the same problem over again. Don't look at the answer and take the spectral information and rework it on your own. Yes. There's probably plenty of worksheets online. I will, if you want me to, look during your cleanup or the last part of lab here, try to find a couple of problems in the book that look reasonable for you to work on. But yes, the NMR problems are very common, so I'm sure you can find some kind of resource. Any questions on this problem? Then... this is our last chance really to do lab, unless you do want to do IR on Thursday after your lab quiz, although we'll be checking out. So if you haven't already done so, start cleaning up your glassware. We're obviously not going to have the time to do NMR analysis of lab 3, so lab 3's sample you can go ahead and get rid of. And the only reason I'm asking you to do the cleanup ahead of time is so we can do the checkout as quickly as possible. We will probably do checkout first and then do the lab quiz. So you do still need to show up right at 7:30, because if we're waiting for you to check out, it's not going to work very well. I want to check out as a unit. So, any last questions before we end? Yes?
I was going to ask, alkenes are the only cases that hydrogen is put in one position?
Yes, so far. The other case would be diastereotopic protons, but you're not going to have a problem like that.